Welcome back to Return On Podcast, where we talk about the experiences, obsessions, and habits of the most successful e-commerce entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Tyler Jeffcoat. I want to welcome you to the show today. Guys, I'm really excited to get to interview a friend of mine, Peter Becke. He's one of the founders of the Hawkers Club. This is one of the really great boutique-y Amazon ad agencies, Amazon marketing partners that are out there. In this discussion, we're going to dive into how to pivot your ad strategy based on the margin. Like, let's say, for instance, you have small and light products that are getting disrupted by Amazon fees. How does that potentially impact your advertising strategy? Or if you have a sense that some of the variations of your products are winning and some of them are losing, what can you do to aim your strategy and make it more nuanced? And then he's going to talk to us about how you may want to consider putting a little bit more of your budget into DSP instead of the impressions-based Amazon advertising. Not a large percentage, but he's going to talk about it. You know, how much of your budget needs to be probably reallocated into DSP for most of our brands that are selling on Amazon. So I hope you enjoy today's interview with Peter from the Hawkers Club. TheHawkersClub.com is his website. Again, I'm Tyler. And as always, these episodes are presented by Seller Accountant, which is my company. Enjoy the show. It's time to maximize profitability and cash flow. It's time to learn habits and hacks from the best e-com CEOs. It's time for Return On Podcast with me, Tyler Jeffcoat. That first part, let me start over there. Today, I am excited to invite Peter Becke into the show. Peter's one of the founders of an Amazon marketing agency called Hawkers Club, and he is an ex-Amazonian. Peter, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thank you for having me, Tyler. I'm pleased to be here.
So yeah, before we hit record here, Peter, you mentioned that you are recently moved. I can just think like of the top five most pleasant things to do in my life. It's been moving. How are you guys adjusting to Colorado?
Yeah, not too bad. I must say that running up the stairs, I was surprised that it does take a bit more effort than it did in Chicago. So I was surprised by that, but I'm getting used to it. And I'm in love with the mountains. I think they're beautiful.
That's great. Yeah, I guess you're like naturally in slightly better physical condition just living in the Rockies, right?
Because like exactly, yeah.
Literally the effort required to get up and go get a snack burns more calories if you're in the Rockies.
Exactly. You reconsider whether or not it's worth it. So I had some catching up to do.
Love it. So Peter, I want to talk a little bit about your journey, and then we're going to dive into some Amazon advertising strategy. So you worked with Amazon, you worked, I think, with Microsoft and a couple other companies. Can you give us a little bit of the sense of what went wrong, man, where you decided to pivot and become an entrepreneur? Like, that's, are you crazy? What's wrong with you?
What I value more than anything in, so like, obviously I stayed in the e-commerce world, right? So I believe in Amazon. I think it's awesome what they do. And the most important thing for me was that I very much like doing my own thing and running my own schedule, doing things the way I like. So if you like, it's a super specific thing. And having my own business gives me that flexibility and freedom to do that. Whereas, as you can imagine, in a big corporates like Microsoft, like Amazon, everything is very structured. Everything is very like pre-planned. And I think my personality is a better fit for something smaller and something that gives me the freedom and the flexibility to, you know, if I want to develop a new division in my business, then I invest my money, my time into it. And then if it works, then I get obviously the rewards and I don't need to go through millions of upper level stakeholders to get the approval and the authorization. So I quite like that I can take the initiative, grab it and afterwards the market will tell me if I made a good decision or not. I really like that sort of risk reward model, and it's more, I suppose it's more intense when you run your own business as opposed to being in a big corporate, and it's really invigorating for me. So on top of the free time, that's the or the freeness or freedom of work. This is the second reason why I really like running my own business.
Yeah, it's something I've thought about a lot because when I was 2012, it was a little over a decade ago. I left a Fortune 100 bank to found my first company. And there was nothing in my life that was like more terrifying than the prospect of, you know, at that time, my wife had just quit her job. We had like a 6-week old, like it was kind of that season of life, you know? And And yet, I think one of the reasons I always bring up this question on this on the Returnal podcast show here, Peter, is that taking that entrepreneurial leap has been one of the most rewarding things that I've ever done in my life. Right? It's scary. But the idea, and here was the mindset shift for me. I was in an MBA class prior to starting my business. And I remember one of my mentors in that class saying, "You think it's risky starting a business?" He's like, "But you're wrong. If you work for a corporation, you have one paycheck and you're a number." If Peter and I own firms, and you guys that are listening to this own companies where you have, you know, Peter and I might have hundreds of customers or dozens of customers. You guys probably have thousands of customers. You got a whole bunch of people sending you paychecks every month. And I think that mindset shift was really crucial to me kind of wanting to embody being an entrepreneur. And then, yeah, so I mean, I could see that being the case for you. So was it easy sailing? Like when you started I'm not even sure how long you've been in this business. When did you start Hawkers Club?
7 years ago. So that's when me and my business partner both left Amazon, and we've been in business for the past 7 years. I completely agree with both of the previous points that first it takes a big leap of faith in yourself, and there are no guarantees. But when you couple it with what you said as well, that, you know, the corporate job tends to be portrayed as giving you the security. At the end of the day, that security is one paycheck. So one advice I got from one of my friends that had been running his business for a while prior to me leaving Amazon is, you know, make sure you have that one, two, three paychecks on a savings account, and then you've got a higher level of security than what you had at Amazon, right? And that helped me make that mindset shift as well, as and completely agree on what you said as well. So now I actually feel more secure financially than 7 years ago back at Amazon.
And if you think about it, we're feeling some recessionary pressures right now, Peter. And I have a lot of friends that make a lot of money working for gigantic corporations that are pretty, to your point, that are pretty scared right now because a lot of white collar workers in the States are getting canned, literally getting shit canned with a couple of weeks severance because the economy's bad. And for you and me, and for most of the people that would listen to this podcast, well, we get to make hard decisions and we're feeling the pressure. By the way, that's why you and I are up at 2:30 in the morning in the fetal position, you know, hoping we can make payroll at the end of the week.
Exactly.
Oh, it's a different kind of pressure, but it, like you said, I think you used the word freedom 3 or 4 times there. I think it's been a major pivot. So I appreciate you sharing that. So thinking about Amazon advertising strategy, this is really where you're a guru. I really trust your insights. And I see this space evolving quite a bit, Peter. Can you give us some insights into where you're seeing Amazon ad strategy evolve?
Sure. So first, when we talk about the inventory that Amazon has added, the available inventory that sellers and vendors can bid on, that's increased. And I think that's great because it helps. It gives additional placements and additional opportunities to target customers, which is awesome. I think one thing that is really working is video ads. And that's something I want to recommend to everyone. Usually the sort of rule of thumb is if you upload a video for your product, make a 20-25 second version of that video, just have it cut down and then use that as a video ad. It tends to do awesome. So that's number one. If someone's not leveraging that, then I'll do that immediately. The second trend, which is, so we'll talk about three trends. The second one is that via the DSP console, Amazon's introducing more and more ad products, and product placements in, let's say, Amazon Prime Movies is becoming available. So that's an alpha test right now. Later on, I'm sure they'll roll it out in the next year or so. So I'd be on the lookout for that because I think that's just awesome. And trend number three, Amazon evolved quite a lot the sponsored display part of the ad console. And they have added, I think it was like a year and a half ago, give or take, a VCPM-based bidding, which is all it means is you'll pay for 1,000 impressions as opposed to paying for the click. And what we've seen that do to both the seller and vendor community as a consequence is the more people relied on it, the more it started to eat into and cannibalize their organic sales. Because the placements, so once again, you pay for the impressions, not the clicks. and the placements, like you haven't got an awful lot of control where those placements are and where they are displayed and where they aren't displayed when we talk about the negative targeting part. And just three case studies from the past 2 months is where we've taken over a couple of clients from other agencies. The VCPM-based sponsor display tends to have a high reliance in the agency space because it naturally produces a high ROAS. However, what I usually challenge in that view is, of course, you're getting a high ROAS because you're cannibalizing the organic sales that the product anyways have worked for, right? So we are a bit fooling ourselves, for lack of a better term here. And what we've seen is that reallocating the sponsored display VCPM budget onto DSP, which can display give or take the same inventory placements, so you can bid for same inventory placements and more, and you've got significantly more control over who you target, who you don't target. We managed to reduce in all of these three case studies the ad-generated sales by 10% as a percentage of total. So what we are saying here is that 10% the client used to pay for, and now they don't need to. Especially during these days, if you look at the macroeconomics, what the Fed is doing, all that, that's a massive saving when we talk about profits. And so that's what I'd suggest everyone to just go through your ad console, have a look at how much money you're spending on VCPM, and you know, just try to reallocate it to DSP, whether it's self-serve, managed service, however you can access it. Do that because you're actually going to get more bang for your buck, and you'll stop cannibalizing your organic sales. And in the past half a year, that's been the biggest and most impactful trend that we've seen in the advertising space.
Interesting. So just want to make sure I caught that because that was really rich. So this is a new term for me, guys, but VCPM is basically you're paying for impressions instead of paying for clicks. And there's a understandable but natural cannibalization of our organic sales that can happen because we don't have control over where those ads are displayed. And so what you're recommending, just to make sure I'm hearing the advice here, is to reallocate a portion of that budget into just, I guess, traditional DSP ads where you have more targeting control. Is that kind of what you're saying?
So what we see is the demand-side platform tends to give a much better incremental revenue and new customers, especially new to brand customers. So that's where we always suggest to reallocate that budget, because on the DSP console, you can go super surgical in terms of who you target, how you target. And that's what the sponsored display side doesn't allow. So that's what we are suggesting to look into DSP if you're not already doing it. If you are, just shape that budget onto the demand side platform.
Oh, and I know this is not one of the worst questions I get all the time, and I'm sure you get it too, Peter, is like, what should my actual overall tacos be, or because there's no rule of thumb, right? I mean, I think all so many factors dictate this.
That's a tough one.
But if you took like your typical client and you were to kind of pie chart their advertising budget, like how much of it would you say is going to be sitting in still in kind of traditional sponsored product, keyword based kind of ads versus DSP versus kind of the other bucket, which we'll go into here in a minute?
Mm-hmm. So what I'd say is the following, a couple of caveats. It's highly category dependent because when there's a lot of competition, tacos will naturally lead to increase. And the second is we mainly work with 7-8 figure sellers and vendors. So the data is coming from that perspective. And what we see is between 3-5%, that's a conservative approach. Between 5-8%, that tends to be middle of the road. And 10-12% is the aggressive, is what we are seeing.
I see what you're saying. I know there's, in terms of total ad budget, I've actually heard that a lot also. 3-5 kind of is status quo. There's kind of the middling 5-10. And then if you're going 10-12, you're in more of a growth phase. And then to your point, the biggest caveat that we have is, but you can't even calculate Taco's budget without knowing what your landed cost of goods sold is. So if I have a product I sell for $100 retail and it only cost me $20 to land that product, I'm going to have a much higher budget for advertising. And in fact, the rule of thumb we use is that if I can somehow construct a world where my total cost of goods sold, I'm not talking about Amazon fees, I'm not talking about storage, I'm talking about the landed cost of goods sold plus my tacos. If those two rows on my P&L can be 40% of my budget or less, I'm smoking. And what that means is if I've got a 20% COGS product, I might actually be able to spend 18% on my ads and still kick butt. But a lot of sellers out there have more of a 35% cost of goods sold factor. Well, that guy is only going to have 5 or 6 points that he can afford to put towards the ads and still make any money. Is that kind of what you're saying also?
Yeah, that is correct. That is correct. And to pick up on your second question, in terms of share of budget going to keyword and non-keyword parts. So usually we allocate 10 to 15% of the entire budget to the demand side platform. We tend to have maybe a percent, if at all, on the sponsored display. And most of that will go towards sponsored brands video and sponsored products, because as good as the demand side platform is, it's important to note that it was not designed to replace the sponsored products. It won't help you as much with your keyword rank, organic rank, bestseller rank, and all that. So you really got to understand the role of it. Like, DSP will bring in the new customers, but you still need to keep your sponsored products. Approximately like 80-85% of the budget will need to keep going there just to make sure that you play a rank on site and you got a proper placements for your products.
That kind of makes sense, Peter, because I think the reason that we're all still on Amazon, all of us, is that the return on ad spend at the bottom of the funnel is always so much higher on Amazon. They just command such a gigantic percentage of the initial buyer intent. And so for you to say 85% of my ad budget needs to go towards that bottle of a funnel, keyword specific, I'm pulling the trigger, I'm actually making a buying decision, but it can't be all of it. I was reading Eric Ries' book, a follow-up to the Lean Startup, called The Leader's Guide the other day. And he talks about how and he says kind of similar, 10 to 15% of your budget has to be allocated in growing your audience or growing your platform. And then you've got to have your golden goose is the 85%. The golden goose is the sponsored product ads that we've always spent money on. And so here's my curiosity. So we got 15% of our budget that's allocatable to other advertising mechanisms. Here's the pain point that my clients feel. And I wonder if your clients have felt this also. You know, Tyler, Peter, we want to diversify. We want to drive more traffic that's a little higher up the funnel into Amazon, but we have yet to discover a positive ROI, non-Amazon advertising strategy. I mean, Peter, have you guys found anything that's been helpful for us brands that are struggling to middle through Google and YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn or whatever else we might use to spend ad dollars?
Really interesting question. And so we don't do social media advertising or influencer marketing at all. The reason behind that is when we tried, it was very much a hit or miss. And I couldn't sit down in front of our clients and say, well, this is what you need to do to get an always hit. It still kept being a hit or miss. So we've got some clients that do an awesome job on their social media, and therefore their social media advertising works really well. Equally true for the influencer part as well. Where I would focus on to give an answer to that question is on the demand side platform. I think there's so much targeting or so many targeting methods available for the user, how to drive traffic from outside of Amazon onto Amazon, and whether it's the detail page, whether it's a variation, whether it's the brand store or a landing page with a deal, whatever it may be, you can go so surgical that it can be extremely effective. So one thing that that we recognized is, of course, how you connect complementary products. And which tend to call it a trigger event in the customer's mind. So we work with a company that sells lawnmowers. And so because they design their lawnmowers to specific grass types, in that case, what we do is when the customer purchases that type of grass that we know their lawnmower will work for, we target those customers because 100% of those people will need a lawnmower. Grass won't stop growing, regardless whether or not it's a recession or Fed interest rates and stuff like that. And it works an absolute treat. Now, afterwards, all the customers that purchase their lawnmowers will need the blades sharpened because you use the lawnmower, blades need sharpening, therefore we sell them the sharpening kits. And this logical chain, it works like it's an absolute gold mine. It doesn't stop giving. So have a think about the value chain. Start with your main product, right? What does the customer do before buying your product? Mm-hmm. And because on the demand side platform, Amazon gives you data about all ASINs on site, not just your ASINs. Very quickly, you can figure out that, oh, the customer bought something that will create a need for my product, that I'm just targeting all the customers that bought that prior product that created a need for mine, and I know 100% of them will be relevant to me.
Yep.
That's where you can really make the big bucks.
That's such a great story. I never thought about this, but I've seen it work in so many categories, but I don't know if you guys caught what Peter just said. Like, lawnmowers are normally, historically, they're just lawnmowers, right? I've got a Honda, like it just does what it's supposed to do. But these guys are targeting their lawnmower, whether it's the same exact lawnmower or not, I would assume it's probably similar, but they're targeting over individual species of grass because you might, I found this with so many products on Amazon because of the keyword nature of it. You know, you type in lawnmower and you see South Georgia Bermuda lawnmower pop up and you're like, well, hell, that's exactly what I need. I'll pay $20 extra for that one. That's great.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a great strategy. I love that. And then I love what you're saying there. Like just the lawnmower example is such a great one. If you know, all right, the carburetor is the thing that breaks on the lawnmower that maybe they would search on Amazon to see, should I just, oh crap, I got to spend $100 to replace this carburetor. Let me just search for a new lawnmower for South Georgia Bermuda grass. Ta-da, here's Peter's lawnmower. And so I think the idea of just constructing your customer's buyer journey from first pain to first search to baby buy to they buy your product to, like you talked about, the blade sharpener example, and where there are ancillary needs and pain points and problems that they don't have to go somewhere else. You can solve those problems for them.
Exactly. And, you know, we can go a different example with the whole grass seeds as well. Like, all grass needs watering.
Yeah.
And then you can go down that rabbit hole as well. So when you go this granular, literally you cannot fail. And that's what we've seen with so many brands.
Yeah, my mentor always said, because he owned a really large painting company in Atlanta, and he said, the day that we decided to get so focused, literally we aimed all of our marketing, I believe he said it was on like 40-year-old recently divorced women in Atlanta who were feeling some freedom. They had some budget and they wanted to repaint their house. Like, all of his marketing, the way he trained his guys, the way they entered the building, the way they always put the little footies on. They would never use the bathroom in the house. Like, everything they did was oriented towards her. And they found that when they solved her problem, they actually still got everybody else also. But that there are riches and niches is such a powerful mantra that I think we need to continue digging into.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right. Go ahead, man.
But I hope it helps people become more profitable and accelerate some sales.
So I think just to close this part of the show here, are there any other practical, actually, this would be a great question, Peter. When your team gets a new brand, let's say I have a $5 million brand, and you're starting to dig into either my ad dashboard or pulling up a tool that you're using to analyze it. What are the top two or three low hanging fruit ideas that brand owners out there ought to just take a look at? That would be like, what are the pros looking at to diagnose and take practical, you know, low hanging fruit kind of steps when it comes to improving performance within a
number one is, and to the audience, Tyler and I didn't talk about this. So what actually you suggested earlier, looking at the ASIN level, child ASIN level profitability. That's the number one thing, because not all products are created equal. And I think you hit the nail on the head earlier. usually brands tend to allocate ad spend without looking at that granularity of the P&L of the product. And that's where most brands tend to say, okay, I want my tacos on a portfolio level to be X. Great. But if you are making one of your products wildly negative in terms of profit, the other one is wildly positive, how about we balance it out, right? How about we actually make the product a better fit and then spend ad dollars on it? So number one is child is in level profitability and understanding how much I can spend on advertising, because all products will have a different answer to that question. Number two is the high level budget allocation and how we are targeting customers. What usually comes out of it is, are we cannibalizing organic sales, yes or no? And I just gave the example on the VCPM based sponsor display campaigns. There are other ways as well. Of course, if I'm bidding on my own brand name, that's usually a good source to do a haircut on. So looking for all the ways how we can reduce the organic sales cannibalization. That's ultimately going to increase profit. Therefore, we can reinvest it into new product development, whatever else. And number three is constructing that customer journey that that we just touched on. What is the trigger point for the customer that creates the need for them to consider or purchase my product? Because if we know that, we can be very precise and very surgical. So that's when we sit down with a brand and with the actual people that design the product, if it's a bigger organization, that when you designed this product, what did you have in mind? Talk me through what was the customer need and problem that this product is resolving. And that's what allows us to construct that customer journey, mark the trigger points, and afterwards start a targeting there. So these are the three things I do.
Peter, I can't tell you how refreshing it is to hear that. I obviously, as an accounting firm, you know, we work with several of your peers, and it is so difficult to get marketing agencies to even think about profitability sometimes. And so I think just that first nugget that Peter just dropped is gold, guys. We have to understand the ASIN level margins that we're playing with. You know, hey, if we were in small and light, our advertising strategy just changed. If we had a inbound freight charge that changed materially, then our marketing advertising strategy just had to pivot, because we've just had an expense ratio that is going to put us out of business if we keep running the same play over and over again. And so I think I love the idea of a more nuanced approach, kind of reconstructing my ad campaign on a more granular level so that I can optimize around contribution margin. And for us here at Seller Accountant, it's kind of like that profit margin, but also taking into effect like cash velocity. How can we make it to where we can turn our inventory more quickly, take cash out of the supply chain, that kind of thing.
Completely agree. Completely agree. One of the biggest things that we've seen in the past 2 years as a trend, 2-3 years really since the pandemic, is the percentage of domestic fulfillment, whether it's FBA, FBM, you name it. The cost of that has skyrocketed, and it's been inflated so much that the retail price inflation just couldn't follow it, or at least hasn't so far for most people. And what we are seeing is that people want to push products where, let's say, 30-40% of the retail price is in the fulfillment. Like that product is you know, not really viable on Amazon in the here and now. Maybe it was 3 years ago, but not today. And working that down, whether it's, you know, involving a packaging expert, whether it's redesigning a product, like whatever it may be, just reduce that number, because that's something the customer isn't going to be happier about. That, oh, Tyler, great, your product is actually 40% fulfillment. I don't really mind. I pay the retail price. I want the product. That's it. And this is how we can free up more ad budget if we reduce that number, right? So cost restructuring, and that's the number one driver that we've seen.
So this almost reminds me, Peter, of I played a fair amount of chess. I enjoy the game. It's a lot of fun. One of the hardest moves to see in chess is a backwards move. In other words, you're looking at the board, you're trying to find out what the right strategy is. And if the right move is to move, like, say, a knight backwards, that's actually theoretically one of the hardest moves. Like, it gets missed more than any other. And I think, you know, as consultants, some of the least sexy advice you and I can give to our clients is sometimes to stop selling a product You know, we look at those economics and we say, hey, John, that product 5 years ago was really viable and it looks like it isn't anymore. And you actually are going to get a, I had a conversation with a lady a year ago and we gave her a $50,000 a year raise by killing one of the variants. We just killed a variant, stopped wasting money because it was one of the ones you described this earlier, where you kind of have that one variant that is wildly negative in the midst of an otherwise healthy product. And so anyway, I just want to give you guys this encouragement. I've said this a few times on the show, but like sometimes you should pay me and Peter to tell you to kill a product, because like it's maybe the best advice you get is to figure out which one's broken and stop digging the hole.
Sometimes I agree. It's not a convenient advice for us to say it out loud either, but that's the right thing to say.
Yeah. So, all right, Peter, when you're not, fighting the algorithm, when you're not, you know, looking through the sea of data points coming out of Amazon, what do you do for fun, man? What is it that gives you life when you're not working?
I really like being in nature. And that's one of the reasons why I moved to Colorado, because the Rocky Mountains are just gorgeous, to my taste. So I do a lot of adventure riding with my motorbike. Go up on all the trails, all the passes, all the mountains, and it really relaxes me after a good week of stress to just be there myself and look at all the nature. So that's where I usually go. And in the meantime, I love listening to audiobooks, like Lean Startup that you mentioned earlier.
Good one. Yeah. And if you haven't read his follow-up book, The Leader's Guide, I would definitely check it out. So it's funny to see, but what could be maybe a soft cast on you? Was that a motorbike mishap or something else there?
No. Actually the funniest story with a motorbike and me, it was one of my holidays I took while I was at Amazon. I rode a motorbike solo in Vietnam from Ho Chi Minh City to Hanoi. And I was riding in the mountains in Western Vietnam, close to the Lao border. And then I got a flat tire. Obviously, I didn't carry anything to replace it with or just fix it. So then I started to push the bike backwards, where I knew there was like a smaller settlement. And I just went into the first sort of compound where I saw people. And that was a Vietnamese military post. Obviously, they questioned why I was there and what I was going to do. Now, they didn't speak English. I don't speak Vietnamese. So we obviously got on very well, but they helped me, like great guys. They helped me fix my tire, drove me back to the nearest city. And we had a conversation that's probably the funniest because they didn't speak the same language. Then they asked for my passport, come from the UK. Then we started talking about the Premier Leagues by quoting names and quoting club names. So that's probably the best motorbike story I have.
The international language of connection is Premier League teams. File that away, guys, because you never know when you might be stranded in Vietnam and need to talk shop. So, hey, listen, dude, I think we get a sense of what Hawkers Club does. But let me ask you this. Somebody listening to our show right now, or maybe watching this on YouTube, what is the pain that they're feeling where they need to definitely reach out to your team this week and you can help them?
Sure. So we've got four divisions, the way we structure ourselves. Number one and two are the two closest to my heart, which is direct import supply chain. That's one of my specialties, and the advertising, especially on the demand side platform, is the second. Number three is receivables recovery. When we talk, and that's on the Vendor Central side specifically. We are about to roll it out to Walmart probably in the next month or so. And number four is advisory projects, or like account management, full service stuff. That a lot of our competitors do as well. I think on the first three is where we are probably one of the best, and that's what we'd love to talk to people about.
Awesome. Well, Peter, we're going to make sure that your contact and the website and everything are in the show notes here. It's a great website, guys. Check it out. Lots of good resources. All right, before we close the show here, Peter, I want to ask you the question I ask everybody. It's related to, listen, I'm guaranteeing a return on this podcast, and I got to make sure we give some nuggets and hacks that allow me to stand good on that promise. So what's a practice, habit, routine that has given you an unusual ROI in your life, Peter?
I can't say that I intentionally did it, but I think the how our business has evolved and how our team is structured sort of led the way there. So I split my day into two, and two significant parts, because most of our staff is in Europe. So obviously I can interact with them in my morning hours, and I have the first big block of the day between my 6 a.m. to noon as meetings with clients, meetings with my staff members, and collaborating. And the second part of the day after lunch, that's when sometimes I still take a couple of client calls if I have to, but that's when I can work on my own projects that are dear to me, that I want to drive forward. And I know that I can do that without any interruption. And that puts me in such a good flow, that's where I see the biggest return on investment, that we squeeze all the meetings into the first part, and the second part is just uninterrupted. And that's what I do, or try to do every single day. And on top of that, keep Monday afternoon and Friday afternoon as strictly time for myself to work on the projects that I want to push forward. And I don't take client calls on those days at all. And that's how we've been able to grow the business, and that's been working really well for me.
Yeah, so we all have the same number of minutes and hours, but that ability to manage your energy, I think, is crucial. So, guys, I hope you'll take that. A little time blocking. You'd be shocked at how much a smart human being can get done when they are not interrupted in the middle of flow. Peter Becker, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining the show. Peter is from the Hawker's Nest. No, I'm sorry, not the Hawker. I keep wanting to say Nest. It's the Hawker's Club. TheHawkersClub.com. We'll make sure that website is very easy to get to in the show notes here. Peter, this has been a thrill, man. Thank you so much for joining me on Return on Podcast today.
Tyler, thank you for having me, and all the best.
All right. So with that, we're going to close today's episode. Thank you again for listening to Return on Podcast with me, Tyler Jeffcoat. Hey guys, if this content serves you, help me out. Like, subscribe to the channel, help us get the word out there, because we're trying to grow the channel as much as we can. And until we see you next time, take care. Have a great week. Thank you.